In the garage of Dr. Frank Conrad, on November 2nd, 1920, the first scheduled pre-advertised radio program in the United States went on the air. Station KDKA was broadcasting returns of the presidential race on the evening of Election Day. From a humble beginning in a Pittsburgh garage to the sumptuous studios of the national radio networks in New York, Chicago, and Hollywood, these years have come to be known as the Golden Era of Radio.
Horn Comics presents Stage Door Canteen, starring tonight Luella Park, Hollywood.
Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The transcribed story of the violence that moved west with young America. And the story of a man who moved with it.
I'm that man, Matt Dillon.
Dr. Christian's office.
WTIC Radio presents the second program in a series that will explore this golden era. Brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, with offices at Corbin's Corner, West Hartford, 267 Main Street, New Britain, and Slater Road, New Britain. Burritt, where you'll benefit from 81 years of banking experience. Good evening. This is Dick Bertel, and with me as co-host for the next hour is the man with 2,000 hours of radio memories on tape, Ed Corcoran. Well, Ed, what have you brought for us tonight?
Well, Dick, we have quite an assortment this evening. We have a documentary. We have a story about wartime intrigue. We have some stories about jury trials, soap operas, and kids shows. So
wow,
I think we covered the waterfront tonight.
That's a great lineup. Our special guest this evening is Charles Harrell, now headmaster of the Austin School here in Hartford, formerly executive producer of television for ABC, Eastern Program Director for the NBC, Blue, and ABC radio networks, and director of some of the most exciting and memorable radio shows of that golden era, shows we're going to hear tonight. Charlie, actually, you survived those three networks, NBC, Blue, and ABC. They really were all one, weren't they?
Yes, they were just, it started out as NBC, Blue, then the government, the FCC, ordered a separation of the two networks of NBC, and it became the Blue Network Company, and then it became later the American Broadcasting Company. This is through the regimes of famous names like Ed Noble and Mark Woods, and the last president I worked for of the old Blue Network was Mark Woods. And then when it became American Broadcasting Company, the new president was Robert Kintner, who's now, I think, or was chairman of the board of NBC and RCA. I guess he was head of RCA, too, for a while.
I don't want to date you, but I do want to find out when you did enter this field of radio.
Well, my first radio job was in Kansas City over WDAF on a show called The Nighthawk Frolic, featuring Coon Sanders Orchestra.
I remember the show. I remember hearing about the show. I don't remember the show directly.
I was 11 years of age, and I used to sing a song with Carlton Coon, who lived across the street from me in Kansas City, and the song I sang was Here Comes My Ball and Chain. First radio experience. That was in 1924.
Well, that goes back. When did you first arrive in New York?
Well, I graduated from the University of Michigan, and I took a master's degree there. But between the AB and the master's, I decided to be an actor, and I went to New York. I had acted all through college, and I'd been in stock companies as a boy. I ran away with a tent show when I was a youngster and spent several summers with a company headed by Guy Kibbe, whom I saw last night on 42nd Street in the movie.
Right.
And I went to New York and tried my hand as an actor, and I was a monumental failure. I got one job on the old March of Time, and I decided this wasn't for me. Went back and took a master's degree, became a school teacher, and then entered radio again and became a director and producer.
Well, we're going to hear from the March of Time in just about 1 minute, but first this message.
Please take the stand, ma'am. Raise your right hand. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Do you have a savings account at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank?
I do.
Do you have it there for their high dividends, compounded monthly, figured from day of deposit to day of withdrawal?
No.
in order to take advantage of Burritt's 6% certificates or the popular 5 3/4% 1-year certificates?
No.
Well, do you have it at Burritt for their 3 handy offices, 2 in New Britain and 1 in West Hartford?
No.
You patronize Burritt because of their new modern buildings, their friendly tellers, and fast, efficient service?
No.
Well, tell the court, ma'am, in your own words, why you consistently do business at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
Because they are mutual.
What, you all?
Mutual. They work for us. Their profits go to us in dividends and reserves. As depositors, we own them. For me, for you, for the judge, everybody.
There will be a slight recess in this court while I start my account at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
I guess the March of Time, Ed, was one of the earliest and greatest radio dramatic shows and documentaries, wasn't it?
It had to be among the best, and before we went on the air, Charlie was telling us about the fact he appeared on the show as an actor, and I wonder whether you could tell us how that came about, Charlie.
Well, that was my first and only job as radio actor in New York. I tried to get on the show. I went up to BBD&O, that's Batten, Barton, Durston, and Osborne, and the receptionist was a kid I'd gone to college with. We were both kids, and he had been a barber, and I saw him as a receptionist, and he said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm trying to get a job as an actor." And the producer of the show was Arthur Pryor, who was later to become an advertising executive, son of the old bandmaster, and brother of Roger Pryor, a very fine actor. And Arthur would dash through the hall, and he'd try to stop him, and one day he stopped him and said, "This is my friend. He wants an audition." And he said, 4:30, studio something or other at CBS, and I went up. And Ed Jerome, a great and distinguished radio actor, was doing Haile Selassie while Mussolini was invading Ethiopia. But Ed had called in sick. And none of the actors there, including some very fine radio actors, could pronounce the name of the capital of Ethiopia. And Arthur was storming around, and he said, "Can't anyone say the capital?" And he couldn't say it. So I said, "I can." And he said, "What is it?" And I said, "Addis Ababa." Everybody else had been saying Addis Ababa. And I said, "Addis Ababa." He said, "You've got the job." So I became highly selected. Did the part. It was a sort of a high-pitched voice.
Could you try it for us now?
Well, give me something here to read. I'll read this cast of characters from the March of Time in the manner of Haile Selassie. Ted Husing, Harry Fonsell, Westbrook Van Voorhis, Bill Adams, Art Carney, and Stotz Cotsworth will meet me at the Imperial Palace in Addis Ababa.
No wonder they invaded the country.
A short live radio acting career, I see.
It didn't last too long, but until Ethiopia fell, and I sure was pulling for them, but they didn't make it.
Yeah, when you were out of a job, huh?
When did you take over as director of that show?
Well, I was a substitute director on that show. The show was more, Ed Byron directed it a great deal of time. Arthur Pryor was always the supervising man at the top of it. And Westbrook Van Voorhis, a Connecticut man from Kent, was, of course, the world-famous voice of time. I filled in on the show, especially when it became a 15-minute strip for Wrigley, I think it was, across the board. And I did it about, maybe 2 weeks out of a year. I'd fill in when Ed Byron would ask me to. Ed sort of looked out after my career as a director in the early days.
Was Art Carney on that show?
Yes. Art Carney was on every show. He was a fabulous actor. He still is, of course, on television. But Art, many voices, many skills, and great intelligence in his performing with shows.
This was, of course, before the days of actualities, Ed, where you take a tape recorder out and actually interview the person. And I guess Art Carney was voice of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yes, he did Franklin Roosevelt. There were 3 or 4 actors that specialized as Roosevelt. I can't remember their names now, but I remember that most of them would do Roosevelt and could do Churchill as well. It was a peculiar kind of quality to both voices that the same actor could do both well. Maury Tarplin, who did Japanese voices and was always Hirohito, played Winston Churchill superbly.
Well, we're going to take you back right now, Charlie. Where does this come from, Ed, this particular March of Time?
This is a wartime version, I would say around 1943, and Charlie might be able to identify a couple of the voices in here. They're rather famous.
What's the year?
1943, about that time.
Let's listen together, then, to the March of Time.
March of Time. Bringing you a dramatic story of history in the making, based on material made available by the news and picture bureaus of time and life and fortune.
Tonight, the March of Time brings you a camera's eye view and an on-the-spot report of the U.S. Navy's first major action in this war, the Task Force attack on the Marshall Islands. The task of keeping Americans informed on this far-flung, momentous battle of the Pacific is a big one, and a challenge. To meet this challenge, the men of the news and picture bureaus of time, life, and fortune have traveled with the Army and the fleet, have been in many fields of action, in Honolulu, Australia, Burma, Corregidor, and on the high seas. Before war had even broken out in the Pacific, top flight photographer Robert Landry of the news and picture bureaus of Time, Life, and Fortune was in Honolulu. During December and January, Landry was almost constantly at sea with different units of the Pacific Fleet. And like many another news and picture bureau correspondent throughout the world, he was becoming wise in the new methods of warfare, trained in the techniques of picturing and reporting it. Thus, it was not accident when a special fleet task force left Pearl Harbor, destination unknown, that Robert Landry went with it. That is how this evening the March of Time can reenact for you the dramatic naval action of a force of cruisers, destroyers, and aircraft carriers at the Japanese fortified Marshall Islands, as it was seen by one of its own representatives who was there when it happened.
Hi, Casey.
Oh, hello, Landry. Oh, boy, it's tough trying to catch a nap on one of these things. Down below here, this baby throbs like a five-star hangover.
You know, Casey, after 2 days, I've made an interesting discovery about this stateroom of ours.
Yeah, what's that?
On one side, we've got a powder magazine. On the other, a storeroom full of shells. And I don't mean pecan shells.
This is some canoe ride.
Yeah. I'm going to be careful where I toss my cigar butts. Say, I just wrote a letter to a friend of mine about it. Want to hear it?
Yeah, give it the broadside.
Here it is. Just imagine when you go home to your apartment tonight, you take 50 other people with you. You're all going to be there a month. Now, imagine your apartment is being turned upside down all day and all night. If you want to get a little fresh air, all 50 of you have to crowd into your backyard, which is also bouncing up and down 24 hours a day.
Keep going, boy. You're better than Joseph Conrad.
Come in.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Oh, good morning, sir.
I'm Lieutenant Commander Porter, the medical officer. Skipper asked me to look in and see if you're comfortable.
Thank you, sir. Everything's swell. I'm Bob Landry of Life. This is Bob Casey of the Chicago Daily News.
Glad to know you, Doc.
How do you do?
Tell the skipper not to give us a thought.
Well, would you gentlemen care to make a tour of the ship and get a look at our home life, so to speak?
Well, that's swell, Doc.
Well, I guess we might begin with the soda fountain. Up the companionway on the starboard side, gentlemen.
You see, my manager tells me to go get this monkey.
Let me have a good time.
Me too. Three scoops of chocolate.
I'm watching for an opening. Well, anyway,
Susie, hand me the phone book, will you, please? What are you looking for, Kathy?
Banks. Savings banks. Let's see. Here's one in the yellow pages. Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Main Street, New Britain. Slater Road, New Britain. Corbin's Corner, West Hartford. Compounds dividends monthly. Pays day of deposit to day of withdrawal interest. Certificates of deposit at 6% for 2 years and 5.75% for 1 year.
You want to start a savings bank account, Kathy?
Yes, and definitely at Burritt.
Why Burritt?
Because it's a mutual bank, Susie. It's working for us. You own part of it if you're a depositor, and its profits go to you.
Say, can I start an account there with you, Kathy? Gosh, I'd love to have a bank working for me.
Adventure. There's 30 minutes of it Sunday afternoon when David Harding, counter spy, is heard over most of these stations. DDF. That stands for Descendants of the Founding Fathers.
But what was it? A legitimate organization or a phony setup for a dangerous racket? Join David Harding when he cracks this case Sunday afternoon on Counterspy.
3 o'clock. You remember that one, Charlie, do you? Yeah, I do. Yes, you were associated with that show. You were its director for a time.
I directed it for a number of times, and my close friend, a very close friend in those days, Don McLaughlin, played David Harding, Counterspy. He's now on a soap opera,
As the World Turns.
He's the head of the family on that. Don's such a fine actor. He's out of the University of Iowa. Very good actor.
As a matter of fact, Don, too, is from Connecticut. At least he was. I know I spoke to him a few years back.
I saw him about 5 months ago, and I said, "Why are you killing yourself on that soap opera?" And he said, "Just one kid more to get out of college, and then it's all over."
That's beautiful. Now, let's take a show like Counter Spy. When would rehearsals begin for a program that was on Sunday, let's say, at 3 o'clock?
I began on Saturday, or usually Friday on that show, and you would have a cast call for 2 hours, read the script through, time it, make the script changes and alterations and cuts, bring it close to its timing, work on little internal reading scenes a little bit, but not much. Then you'd turned over to the writers for rewrites and changes and sharpening that they would do. Probably meet on Sunday. If it was on the air at 3 o'clock, usually the call would go out about 11 o'clock. You put it all together. You do the actors from 11 till 11:45 or 12. From 12 to 12:30, you'd do the sound. From 12:30 to 1, you'd clean up the music cues. From 1 to 1:30, you do a run-through in which you really put it together as a show, check it out, do your criticisms, dress rehearse it at 2:15, 2:10, 2:15, run the half hour, take a 10-minute break, and put it on the air.
Would you have to do a repeat for the West Coast?
Well, we used, in the early days of radio, you have to do it twice, with a three-hour differential. But when recording came in, acetate recordings came in, well, then you just did the one. The actors loved it. They got double fees, and it made it simple. They'd do it once and then pick up the recording fee.
So the show was live then when we heard it on the East Coast?
In the East, it was always live. And then we'd sometimes get recorded repeats from the West, but the quality wasn't so good. Sponsors didn't like it too well, and the networks didn't like it either because it didn't have the bite. Tape, of course, now you can't tell the difference between whether it's taped or live.
Was this Counterspy patterned after something in real life, or was this entirely fictional?
Entirely fictional and completely improbable, based on not one scintilla of fact, because if it had any facts in it, someone was going to call up and raise Cain with you anyway. So, no truth in it.
You avoided that completely.
Truth had no place in radio drama, believe me.
Charlie, did you work directly for the networks when you were a director, or
well, I put in a period of time with the Hummerts, who owned most of the soap operas. But then that was very temporary. And then but most of my time, I was always with the networks, and until I went over to an advertising agency. After television came in 1948, I worked in television for 4 years, then went to the advertising agency field. But I didn't freelance much until, I spent a couple of years freelancing famous jury trials. Where I owned the show and directed and produced it and wrote it as well, but that was the only one I ever did that for.
Well, would you be assigned then to a program the way an announcer would be assigned to a staff position?
You picked up a fee for doing the show. Usually we worked on a salary, and then any show we got a fee for doing it. And sometimes that could be very lucrative because my salary as a director at ABC in the early days was around $6,000, $6,500, which would be a very modest salary today, but in those days would be the equivalent probably $12,000, $13,000 a year now. And then for doing a David Harding Counter Spy, your fee was $500. You did very well for yourself.
I guess you did.
You had 6 or 7 shows a week. You did very well.
Well, that was my next question. How many shows would you
the maximum number of shows I had? I had 5 half hours across the board in the day, 3 half hours in the evening, and 2 television shows all on the air at once.
That was an exciting career.
It sure was.
We're going to hear more from that career with the actual sounds right after this.
Kathy, where are you going so fast?
To the bank, Richard. I've got to put this money away before I spend it.
Where do you bank, Kathy?
Where everybody banks, silly. At Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
At what Mutual Savings Bank?
Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. I use their convenient Corbin's Corner office in West Hartford. But they also have two offices in New Britain.
Well, why the Burritt, Kathy?
It's one bank where I can get 6% for 2-year certificates and 5.75% for 1-year certificates. My money really earns there.
How about their 90-day accounts, Kathy?
Oh, they have them, Richard, at 5.25% compounded monthly.
Why do they have Mutual in their name?
Because they're owned by their depositors, Richard, and the profits go to them in the form of dividends. Burritt is the only bank around here with Mutual in their name.
Well, take care, Kathy. I've got to get back to work.
Where do you work, Richard?
At Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
What do you do?
I take public opinion polls.
How wonderful, Richard. Would you ask me some questions sometime?
Well, Charlie, we have an excerpt from that very famous show of yours, Famous Jury Trials, and I really had to search very long and hard to find this. It's not really in great circulation. And, again, let's listen to it and see if you can identify any of the members of the cast.
I'll remember the gavel.
Okay, let's hear it.
Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you are the judges of the evidence to be laid before you. Be just and fear not. For the true administration of justice is the foundation of good government. Famous jury trials, dramatizations of cases taken from actual court history. The names of persons and places have been altered to protect the identity of those concerned. The State versus William Wright. It was on a raw, foggy April day some years ago that the freighter Golden Pheasant steamed up New York Harbor to her berth in Jersey City. And scarcely had the vessel docked before a police patrol that had been notified and was waiting on the dock, boarded the Golden Pheasant, began questioning the members of the crew. There had been a murder aboard the Golden Pheasant. In his cabin lay the body of the ship's captain, James Bruce, bloodstained, horribly mutilated. Within a few hours after the freighter had docked, the police announced that they had arrested William Wright, the ship's cook, and charged him with the murder of Captain James.
All right, Charlie, does that bring back a memory or two?
Well, this is not one I was associated with, as I can recall, but the voice is not, the narrator is not I'm sure it isn't Roger DeCoven. And Roger DeCoven, I know, narrated most of the shows that I did, because he was a permanent narrator on the show. But other directors on that show, I noticed some of the names like Wiley Adams, Carl Eastman, Nolan Powers, and Clark Andrews. These were all staff men at the network, and then when I became program manager, I would take over or assign from time to time. But I think, I don't know who that voice is that does that narration. It's very British-y to me. Doesn't sound right.
Was this the first time that this type of drama was ever done on radio, this courtroom drama, to your recollection?
Well, courtrooms were always great. You know, it's just like soap operas today. You have trouble, get the girl pregnant. And if that doesn't work, well, then let's have a courtroom scene. And if that doesn't work, let's get to the hospital. And if that doesn't work, let's have someone meet somebody, you know, and start a new sequence. And the same thing was true with radio. This was not an innovative show by any stretch of the imagination. It was you'd ground them out, just like you'd put... Famous Jury Trials was once described by George G. Nathan with the perfect sentence, that the problem of the producer and the director and the writer each week was to find new ways to put skin on baloney.
That's beautiful.
So this, again, was fictional, I take it.
Yes, entirely. Entirely.
Shattering my faith in radio
these
here.
These famous jury trials were famous only to the people who worked on them.
You're listening to the Golden Era of Radio from WTIC in Hartford, Connecticut. This is Dick Bertel. Your co-host is Ed Corcoran, the man with 2,000 hours of radio memories on tape, and our guest tonight is Charles Harrell, now headmaster of the Austin School here in Hartford, and formerly director of some of the most memorable radio shows of that golden era we speak of tonight. Charlie, I noticed that over and over you hear the same radio voices on these programs. Why is that?
Well, you could bend on them. You could depend on them, and you didn't have to. You hired a person because the quality of his acting, quality of his performance, and you didn't have to do anything with it to get the performance out of it. out of the performer, and it could be done efficiently. And we worked under very fast conditions, very very speedy. And we had our stock companies, and if you cracked that sort of thing, you became in on the radio scene. You made a very, very good living. And just like the people who played on soap operas did not play often at night because they were tied up. And the people who played the nighttime shows would fill in the smaller parts in the soap operas. But they all had a unique quality and a fresh sound, and you hired a person because he had that sound. That's why you used him.
Would you audition each time, or would you cast from memory?
Cast from memory, and usually you had a casting director. The networks had their own casting director. Ed Begley's brother, Martin Begley, was casting director for NBC and from Hartford here. And I know Martin cast nearly all the shows that I did that were ever on NBC radio. And I can't remember the name of the woman. Helen Hedeman was the woman who cast most of my shows on ABC. And there's an agent in New York doing awfully well now, and I can't remember her name. Doris Quinlan. Doris Quinlan was the casting director for CBS.
Doris Quinlan, as a matter of fact, was associated with, I remember, Mama. Do you remember that television show
back in 1950? That was a West Coast origination, as I recall, but I remember it, yes.
Yeah, Ralph Nelson directed it. It was done live,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, Ralph, incidentally, is one of the few directors who made the transition from radio to television to motion pictures and was very successful in all three forms of entertainment.
We made mention of the Hummerts before, and
Frank and Anne.
That was quite a dynamic duo, wasn't it?
they are, yes. Now that you mention it, that's the original Batman and the company. But the Hummerts owned dozens of radio shows, and they would grind them out, hire their own staff, hire their own actors, and turn these out with remarkable celerity. It was very rapid with them, and they had an empire of their own.
You mentioned Ed Begley. Of course, Ed was associated with Charlie Chan for many years. We were going to play at Charlie Chan tonight. Unfortunately, the only copy of this show which exists is not really airworthy.
Oh,
it's all but, not understandable.
Well, I would just like to say something, even to go mention right here, that Ed Begley not only was a superb actor, but he was one of the superb human beings that I've known. And he visited our school, the Austin School, here in Hartford, when we first started and came out and spent a whole day with the kids. And he was a great guy, and it's a real loss, his death, I think.
We're going to hear from one of those great soap operas with which you were associated, Charlie, right after this.
Jim, where can we get those new 6% two-year certificates for our savings?
At Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
What mutual savings bank?
Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. You know, in New Britain and at Corbin's Corner, West Hartford.
Is this a good, safe bank, Jim?
There's none better. It has assets of almost $100 million and federal deposit insurance to $20,000. It's a mutual savings bank, the only bank in New England with mutual in its name.
Is that good, Jim?
It sure is. It means they operate for the people. Their profits go to the people who save there.
How about those 5.75% one-year certificates and 5.25% 90-day accounts?
Burritt has them all.
Why don't we start a savings account there, Jim?
Well, why not? In fact, why don't we start a joint account?
Jim, I thought you'd never ask.
It's true, folks. You can have a joint account, a single account, any type of savings bank account at your mutual savings bank in Hartford County, the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank. Save where you see mutual in the name and where safety is the game at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, New Britain and West Hartford.
Well, Charlie, we're going to hear young Dr. Malone, but before we do, isn't there a story about the hypodermic syringe about that show? That
I'm going to turn, I'll louse this up because... this was a case of course, fluffs in radio are just hysterically funny to the people who are in radio and sometimes very dull to people who are out. But I know that the one great occasion, and it is true, that the young Dr. Malone, in a very moving hospital scene, called immediately for the hypodermic needle and never did get out of the thing for about 30 seconds. Most of the fluffs that occur on radio, of course, are not even, you couldn't put on the air without getting thrown off, but that was one that stayed in for a long time. Incidentally, speaking about fluffs, Dennis James, who's still in, I remember the first show that Stop the Music did, which was one of my shows for the network. Mark Goodson was the director of the show and part owner of it. And you know that Dennis James, it was sponsored by Old Gold Cigarettes, mm-hmm. delivered the commercial, and on the air, at the very end, he said, "And this Stop the Music has been brought to you by the makers of Lucky Strike." And away we went, and he never did figure out why he said it. He said it.
All right. Let's get off the hypodemic nurdle and listen to young Dr. Malone.
Now, CBS Radio presents Young Dr. Malone, featuring Sandy Becker.
So you mean, at the last minute, Molly West was the holdout?
Not holdout, Tracy. Ted seemed grateful to her for cutting across the grain of this affair and revealing the reality behind it.
But he still needed Marcia.
Damn it, basically, he didn't want the post of medical director. At heart, his love is still surgery.
You mean Ted has given up ambition for love? I wonder about that, Jerry.
Well, I doubt whether it's as clear-cut as all that, but whatever Molly actually told him, it must have been potent. Because, well, he's getting on that plane in about 15 minutes and just flying away from it all.
Molly, as well as his wife. Well, the clinic, darling, what about the clinic?
Ted thinks I should go back as medical director.
Oh?
Yeah. And so do I. That's where I belong. Where I've always belonged. Might as well make George Allen happy.
Oh, everyone will be happy to see that settled.
Which leaves Jill and Scotty. What about them, Tracy?
Well, things look sort of up in the air now, but everything will work out by tomorrow.
Preparations for the wedding, you mean?
Naturally. What do you mean?
You know.
Oh, darling, there's no chance of that. Mrs. Scott will never break down now. And if that's the way it is, then Bill and Scotty will simply have to reconcile themselves to it.
To half a wedding?
Oh, Jerry, that's
that's what it's going to be, for those kids to have to go through that ceremony knowing that Mrs. Scott is sitting in a room at the Red Lion Inn and hating them. Would you like to go through that kind of a wedding?
I'm not the bride. I'm the mother of the bride, which leaves me enough to worry about.
Ah, memories there.
Well, Charlie, when you designed or you worked on these shows, what was the general premise? How did you try to keep the action going or not to keep it going, as the case may be?
Well, you put it effectively on the second one. The premise of a soap opera is very simple. You spin out a story that glamorizes mundane activities so that the person at home sees in glamorous surroundings, in glamorous situations, and in glamorous conflict, monumental conflict, the very same things that she gossips about during the course of the day. That works. And it works because it works with men as well. If you ever stand in a bar and listen to men standing around telling each other how great they are, this is the same premise. You don't want to hear anything about failure. You want to hear about triumph of misery over triumph of happiness over misery. And you want to hear it in your own kitchen. And it's a great premise, and I don't denigrate at all the soap operas. I think they perform a useful function. They keep women off the picket line.
Did you ever reach a conclusion in one of these episodes and then go on to a new problem?
By mistake, on one soap opera, I don't remember, I didn't do it, but I know on one soap opera, a character walked into a cloakroom to get his hat and never appeared again for 3 years. That brought it to a conclusion. But no, nothing ever ended, unless you wanted to hypo the rating a little bit, and then you had someone, not a principal, die.
Yeah.
And that was usually sudden automobile wrecks, or you wanted to spin it out for a period of time. They got some mysterious incurable disease that no one dared mention, and they lasted for 3 or 4 months before they finally kicked off. And usually kick off on Friday, because you want them back Monday to see what happened.
That's right, that's right. What was the difference in the premise between a daily soap opera and, let's say, a youngster's soap opera in the afternoon?
Well, the kids, those were programmed from 5 to 7:30. The kids home from school. And that means action. and a lot of it, a lot of sound, a lot of fury, a lot of things moving all at once. And the kids loved to find this kind of forward progress. Now, during the daytime, you didn't try that at all. You never dared try anything like that.
Yeah, there were no adventure-type shows on during the afternoon that I can ever remember. It was all, you say, the soap opera variety.
There aren't any on in our entertainment media today.
That's right.
You don't want that kind of excitement. You don't want to move it.
Did you enjoy doing the youngsters-type show?
I hated radio. frankly, I really did. I despised it, and I don't like television very much either. I loved the opportunities to work, and it was really sort of exciting for a while, but it became awfully dull to me. I think radio today, for example, is much more interesting in many respects than radio in the golden days. Because there's a great deal more inventiveness going on in the programming and things like that.
Well, when were you associated with Dick Tracy?
I did Dick Tracy when I was on ABC.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when Matt Crowley was. I did it. I think Mitch Grayson was the principal director on that. And I spelled Mitchell Grayson on the show when he didn't do it. See, my job, this is why I'm taking credits for shows that I really didn't have. Wasn't the principal in. In other words, I moved from one show to another a variety of times. They weren't mine. Matt Crowley was Dick Tracy, and then I can't remember the name of the actor. I know Barry, somebody, was Dick Tracy for a while, but Matt was the one I worked with.
Well, we're going to hear from Dick Tracy right after we hear from this.
Please take the stand, ma'am. Raise your right hand. Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Do you have a savings account at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank?
I do.
Do you have it there for their high dividends, compounded monthly, figured from day of deposit to day of withdrawal?
No.
In order to take advantage of Burritt's 6% certificates or the popular 5.75% one-year certificates?
No.
Well, do you have it at Burritt for their three handy offices, two in New Britain and one in West Hartford?
No.
You patronize Burritt because of their new modern buildings, their friendly tellers, and fast, efficient service?
No.
Well, tell the court, ma'am, in your own words, why you consistently do business at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
Because they are mutual.
What, you all?
Mutual. They work for us. Their profits go to us in dividends and reserves. As depositors, we own them. For me, for you, for the judge, everybody.
There will be a slight recess in this court while I start my account at Burritt Mutual Savings Bank.
Safe. Stand by for action.
Let's go, men.
Yes, it's Dick Tracy, protector of law and order. In yesterday's story, you saw how the evidence began to pile up, making Tracy sure that Spike Connolly was responsible for the dynamiting of the empty safe. You remember, too, how Sergeant Martin, while distributing posters of the description of Spike and his girlfriend, reported to Tracy his suspicions concerning the occupants of a certain house. Jumping into their car, Dick and Pat were soon there. While Dick rang the front doorbell, Pat went around to the rear to forestall any escape from that direction. Inside, Spike and Gert didn't know of Pat's whereabouts, made their way slowly toward the rear of the house. Today, Spike and Gert are almost at the back door. Dick is still ringing the front doorbell. Listen.
Just follow me, Gert. We'll go out this back door and beat it.
But they probably got cops all around the block. We're never going to get away with this, Spike.
Shut up and come on. Head for the back door.
Listen. They're surrounding the block.
Never mind that. Once we're out of here, we can get the car out of the garage and give them the slip. Now, take it easy. I'm going to open the door.
Okay.
It's okay. Come on.
All right, not so fast, you two. Stand right where you are.
Oh, he's got...
Never mind that, sister. Just stay right where you are.
Now, look, mister, we ain't done nothing. We were just going...
Save that. I know who you both are. Now, stick out your hands.
Are you going to handcuff us?
Well, these aren't exactly pearl bracelets. Stick them out, I said.
Now, just a minute, mister, before you get funny with those handcuffs. Just who are you?
Oh, a wise guy, eh? Well, you'll find out that soon enough. No more fooling now. I haven't got any time to waste. Dick Tracy is around the front.
Dick Tracy?
Oh, yes, sir. Oh, so you want to play that way, eh?
Well, here goes me bottle.
Hit him good.
Not this time. Now,
how do you like that, eh?
You head up.
Come on, Spike. I knocked him out. I hit him with my shoe. Let's go.
Yeah. Head for the garage. I saw a car in there.
That's a break. The door wasn't locked.
Quick. Get in. Now, this thing will only start.
Spike, we can't go on the Broadway. The cops.
Hang on.
Gee, Spike, we made it.
That's right, kid. I had to drive through the back of the garage or else go out the front.
They're after us.
Look out the back. Can you see them?
No, I can't see them.
How are you feeling, Pat?
Oh, boy, this head of mine feels as if it had stuffed a Nazi shell. Wow. That dame certainly put everything she had behind that shoe. Look at the lump on the top of my head. Why, I can't even get my hat on, Dick. Oh, wait till I lay hands on that pair again.
Oh, let's get back to the car. I want to contact headquarters.
They certainly made a sucker out of me. What do you think of that dame getting into the scrap? That's what fooled me. Where are the rest of the boys, Dick?
I sent them on a patrol. Driving through the back of the garage completely caught them flat-footed. Oh, here's the car, Pat.
Hey, Dick, isn't that our signal?
That's us, all right. Now turn up the amplifier. Inspector Tracy, go ahead.
Sergeant Ross speaking, Inspector.
Go ahead, Ross.
Flash just came in from the highway patrol. I think it may have bearing on your case.
Yes?
Alan Preston of 575 South Street reports that he stopped to help two motorists that seem to have mechanical trouble with their car.
A man and a woman?
That's right. The minute he got the chance, the man slugged Preston, dragged him into the bushes, and took his car. I've questioned Preston. The description of the man and woman tallies with your bulletin.
Any more details?
The license number of Preston's car was 4159-M, like in morning, with a black sedan, four-door, 1938 model.
Good work.
Here's something else that may help, Inspector. Just as Preston was coming to, he saw the car turn around and start back in a northeasterly direction. The man was driving. The woman was sitting alongside of him in the front seat.
Good. Either one of them armed?
Apparently not.
Thanks, Sergeant. Pat and I will take over. Keep all men on 24-hour duty. Have them stand by for instructions. And pass the word around to the rest of the cars. Have them converge toward Area B.
You, Farmer, get back in here. I'll let you have it with your own gun. You sure you didn't tip them off?
He couldn't have, Spike. I heard every word he said. Anyhow, they've gone off.
Okay. But if they come back, this guy gets it with his shotgun.
Quietly making their way back to their car, Dick and Pat began contacting all the patrol cars and giving them instructions. Be sure to tune in tomorrow, same time, same station, for the adventures of Dick Tracy. This is George Gunn speaking. This is the Blue Network of the American Broadcasting Company.
You were right. We were kind of arguing who I guess the announcer was. It was George Gunn. I thought it was Ernest Chappell. Any of the other members of the cast sound familiar to you?
Well, Mandy Kramer, who's a police inspector on Edge of Night, is in there playing the thug. And Matt Crowley, who was Dick Tracy, is Dick in this. And I can't remember the guy who's playing Pat in this. I don't remember his name.
It was Walter Kinsella, but it wasn't him. It was
that
someone
wasn't
else.
Walter doing no. that. No, Walter Kinsella is a very unmistakable voice and very Irish.
Well, from the same time period, there was a show called Meet Millie. Do you happen to recall that?
Oh,
at all?
Yes, with Lena Verdugo did that, and who is now the secretary on Marcus Welby, M.D.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder what happened to her. But you ever,
that's where she is.
You ever work on that show yourself?
Never did. No, that was a West Coast show.
Made you mention that show? I'm curious.
Well, it was just, I thought it was in the same time period, and I thought I'd ask whether he remembers it. I think Audrey Totter played it on the radio.
Right. Elena Verdugo did it in the early days of television back around 1950.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite shows, Meet Millie, and I thought I would
Elena
see
Verdugo
whether
and Audrey Totter was the script.
We're going to turn now to another of the big nighttime shows with which you were associated, Charlie, The Court of Missing Heirs.
Yes.
Any truth to these stories?
Yeah, there'll be something true coming up sometime.
Well, I'm sorry to say that the Court of Missing Heirs wasn't a court. And the missing heirs were dreamed up by a wonderful man from down in Virginia somewhere who based these on authentic cases, presumably, but we never did find out how they got to be authentic. But the script would arrive, and if it didn't go well, we'd rewrite it and... fix it up one way or the other. I did that show for 3 years running, and I had a lot of fun with it, but...
Well, this is an example, then, of the Court of Missing Heirs.
You may be the heir to $5,000. You may be the heir to $10,000. You may be the heir to $50,000. Yes, you may be the heir to any one of those amounts of money. And today, the latest clues concerning the heirs to $36,632 in unclaimed estates will be unfolded to you on the American Broadcasting Company's Board of Missing Heirs. And here is the counselor and advisor to the Board of Missing Heirs, Mr. James Marshall.
Thank you, John Slagle. Once again, the Board of Missing Heirs is on the trail of person or persons unknown who have money, good cold cash, waiting for them. In the past weeks, we have given the facts concerning the missing heirs to estates valued at $516,500. Perhaps today, you will hear the case that will mean thousands of dollars to you. Listen carefully as the Board of Missing Heirs reenacts the real-life stories of real people who worked to build up fortunes which today are waiting to be claimed, possibly by you. Perhaps you will be the person to answer yes to the question,
are you a missing heir?
Here is the case of Peter Freeze of Colchester, Connecticut, whose estate amounts to the sum of...
$23,000.
Please, sir, what is this town called?
Colchester, Connecticut. Where'd you get that foreign accent?
Perhaps from France. I've come from there only a year since.
Uh-huh. Well, you ought to learn to talk English as you spoke. That's the best way to get on around these parts. You figure to stay here?
I don't know. Is there work?
Well, sure, there's work for them as wants it. You afraid of it?
No, I'm not afraid of it. I won't work very much. I want work where there's plenty of food.
Oh, spunky, eh? And likely looking, too. Now, it happens I know of a man up Lebanon way who's hunting for a fellow with a strong back. You interested?
There's plenty of food.
Dad, blame me, you sound as if you hadn't eaten a square meal in years. Yes, there's plenty of food.
So at last I find this place where there is work and no poverty, and I decided to stay. For 3 years I worked for this farmer, then I took a job with a railroad. When I grew tired of this, I came back to Colchester and went to work with the Westchester paper mill, where I got a good job as a fireman. But I decided a long time ago that I would never again be without money. And so I have saved very carefully all these years. Now I am an old man, and I have a little put aside for the time when I need it. But it is impossible for me to retire. Then I would have no money coming in, and I would have to spend what I have saved.
And a man who had spent his life running away from poverty died like a pauper, although he had $23,000 in cash in his own name.
Next week, the Board of Missing Heirs may broadcast the information that will lead you to answer yes to the question,
are you a missing heir?
James Marshall, speaking for the Board of Missing Heirs and saying goodbye until next week at the same time.
Board of Missing Heirs is produced by James F. Waters and Alfred Chabelle. It's adapted for radio by Don Whitty. Music is by Gene Perazzo,
directed by Charles Harrell. Your announcer, John Slagle.
How does it feel to hear your name once again?
I'm bowing.
That's wonderful. You know, there's something solid and true about things that have survived the years. Music, drama, art, as personified by tonight's presentations, are manifestations of this. Another is a tried and true institution, such as the Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, which since 1889 has existed through good times and bad, war and peace, yet continues to grow and prosper with the years. Safety, service, and growth have been the hallmarks of Burritt's progress, all built on the premise of good customer service. You can save at Burritt with confidence, with pride. Why not start your account today? Offices at Corbin's Corner in West Hartford, 267 Main Street in New Britain, Slater Road, New Britain. Deposits insured to $20,000 by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Well, it's kind of fun to relive these memories, Charlie, and I'm sure that we brought back some surprises to you tonight, haven't
well,
we?
Well, I was surprised. You know, the voice that was on that Court of Missing Heirs show was Joe DeSantis, who's very distinguished and a very fine actor out of Hollywood, just working all the time and seen on many, many TV shows. Joe was a... I didn't think he was very good in that as I listened to it. It didn't sound pretty bad to me. I'll tell you one thing that was true about that show, however. There is a Colchester.
That and an 11 and 2.
And 11.
But basically, the premise was simply that...
they'd find the money, you know, that was unclaimed, and then they'd construct a story about, like, the man died as a pauper, and there would be, you know, they'd set it up. The names were true.
Yeah.
But the facts were all fictional and put together.
Oh, that shatters my mood.
Oh, come on now. You guys are you're sophisticated enough to know. You can't get by with it today.
It'll never be the same again, old-time radio after this.
Well, our special guest this evening was Charles Harrell, now headmaster of the Austin School here in Hartford, formerly director of some of the most exciting, memorable, if not true, programs of the golden era of radio. Thank you very much, Charlie, for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Dick.
Co-host for the golden era of radio was Ed Corcoran with 2,000 hours of radio memories on tape. I'll wager you have something up your sleeve for next time, do you?
Yes, we've got a couple of pretty good people lined up. John Gibson, Peg Lynch, and perhaps even Bill Spear. So we hope to have one of these three on board on the next show, Dick.
Our engineer tonight was Dick Zwirko. Our producer was Brian Hartnett. This is Dick Bertel. The Golden Era of Radio was brought to you by Burritt Mutual Savings Bank, with offices at Corbin's Corner, West Hartford, 267 Main Street, New Britain, and Slater Road, New Britain. Burritt, offering you the best in safe banking and good customer service since 1889.
Dr. Christian's office.
Yes, there's the clock in Glen Falls Town Hall, telling us it's time for Rinso's story of Big Sister, brought to you by the new Soapy Rich.
From the pen of Raymond Chandler, outstanding author of mystery, comes his most famous character and crime's most deadly enemy.
Special material provided for this program by Don Brush and John Knife.
Al Gilson. And now here's the entertainment you've been waiting for. Here's the fellow who let himself go and wound up being Zigbell's biggest folly, Milton Berle.